You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 6th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Bob Marley Day, Mon.
Bob Marley Day in Jamaica and Ethiopia. This is birthday or something?
Does it matter?
I guess someday has to be Bob Marley Day. Just a day to commemorate his songs and everything that he did in his life. So,
Before we get started, I'd like to make a quick announcement. My new blog, Crap-Based Medicine, got a lot of really good feedback after last week. So I went ahead and I made a new post that's at crapbasedmedicine.wordpress.com. I just want to put that out there.
Very nice.
You're going to have to keep up with that blog, Rebecca.
Well, it's going to be tough, but I think I could do it. The fans demand it.
I mean, all the research you got to do to keep up with the latest crap-based research.
It's a lot of research. Today's post is about homeopathy. It took me a lot of time. I hope everybody likes it.
I have a brief announcement, too. I do have to, in the name of full disclosure and fairness, my first prediction for 2008 did not come true.
Oh.
I predicted that the New England Patriots would win the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
They came within 35 seconds, but they didn't pull it off.
Let's not even talk about act of Satan. Let's just move on.
I'm barely over my post-traumatic stress disorder from watching that game.
Perhaps in an alternate dimension they won, Steve, so maybe you can take some solace in that.
No, even denial is not enough for this.
Hey, do you know what else today is?
No clue.
Ash Wednesday.
Oh, that's right. That's
true. Oh, yeah. I saw somebody with the dirt on their face, and I laughed.
Well, let's go on to some news items. We have an interview coming up later in the show with Rich Hayes from the Union of Concerned Scientists to talk about scientists dealing with the media. But first, some news item, and there's a sad bit of news as the first item. The Maharishi Mahesh Yogi has finally passed on beyond his mortal coil.
I'm so sad.
Okay, can you fogies maybe explain the significance of this to me? Because I saw it and I'm just like, huh,
You don't know who this guy is?
This is the guy that the Beatles got into.
Right, the transcendental guy, right?
This is the guy who brought transcendental meditation to the world via the Beatles. Yeah, I guess that's...
See, now here's the thing. Like, these days... Growing up in my generation, I'm going to speak for my entire generation right now and say that we think that people who believe in transcendental meditation are mostly kooks.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking, like, I picture the 70s as being one gigantic acid trip where everybody's holding hands and singing and then meditating. Like, how big was it? Like, was everybody trying transcendental meditation?
What are you asking us for? Anyway, by the way, this was more the 60s. And
whatever.
I had no connection with that entire situation, so I have no idea what you're talking about.
We were watching the Flintstones and the Brady Bunch, okay?
Right. And in the 70s, we were watching Star Trek.
But someone who was around at the time, though, was Mr. James Randi, and he writes about it in his encyclopedia online at randi.org, of course, in which transcendental meditation, TM for short, is a philosophy that also teaches such things as levitation and invulnerability, along with an assortment of other supernatural claims. A study of this is an aspect of Maharishi's science of creative intelligence, which has no scientific characteristics at all. Though wide claims have been made for the effect of TM on the world, none of the claims have stood examination. So, he calls it, it's not only crackpot science, but it's very bad crackpot science.
Now, the media in reporting this, and you know, this is like the kind of thing we're going to be talking about later with Rich Hayes, but I've read and heard several media reports, and they all had the same quip about this, that transcendental meditation was ridiculed by the scientific community, but then was later validated as being effective.
Wrong.
What the hell does that mean?
It had to, because
effective for calming down, maybe.
Exactly, because meditation was shown to lower your blood pressure. Yeah, being calm.
Right. Not effective
your blood
for flying through the air
exactly.
or blowing like fireballs out your hands like that guy in Street Fighter.
That was pathetic.
Every news outlet I heard regurgitated that same misleading soundbite. Terrible.
Lame. And did you guys know that there is a Maharishi University of Management, I guess formerly Parsons College, out in Fairfield, Iowa, and they offer degrees through PhD level on all sorts of, God, who knows what.
Transcendental Management? What?
Maharishi University of Management, or the MUM.
Can you imagine somebody as annoying as a transcendental meditation proponent who also has an MBA? Like, that's like the stuff of my nightmares.
That is pretty frightening.
No offense to all the MBAs out there.
And a little bit closer to home, this reminds me of our own friends, the Moonies, Reverend Sung Young Moon and his University of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And, you know, where they teach all kinds of wonderful things like chiropractic and naturopathic medicine. And
Well, it's, you know, there's a lot of money in cults. You know, they may decide to buy up universities.
And you know, and really, I mean, how many people know that the Moonies run the University of Bridgeport?
Well, let's go on to the second news item. This one is another perpetual motion machine claim, sort of, to being a little bit coy about this one. This one is by inventor Thane Hines, which strangely reminds me that we forgot to mention that Jay is away this week because he is in Sweden.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that came out of nowhere, but okay.
It strangely reminded me of the fact that Jay is in Sweden, which I had planned.
Really good segue.
Anyway.
Speaking of perpetual motion, Jay's not here. Okay. Next news item.
So, you gotta love the title of this. This is the article about it that's in the Star, and they say the title is "Turning Physics on Its Ear," and the subtitle is "Has College Dropout Done the Impossible and Created a Perpetual Motion Machine?"
Is that a trick question?
It's like journalists have the same stories they tell over and over again. Here's the college dropout who's bucking all these mainstream scientists. Has he accomplished the impossible by creating what all the skeptics said couldn't be done? I mean, get a new story to tell. It's getting a little tiring to hear the same story over and over again. But here's the details on this one. So this is a magnetic perpetual motion nonsense where he basically uses a magnetic coil in order to accelerate an engine. So you have an engine that's running, and then he claims that, you know, with this magnetic situation that he has hooked up to it, it can make it go faster. Now he's saying that he's not using the words perpetual motion or free energy or anything like that. He's just saying that it will make it more efficient. But I think he's being coy because if you all the other quotes from him, you know, make it sound very dubious. For example, he says this could be used for what he calls regenerative acceleration, which means that you could use, say, regenerative braking in an all-electric car, and that it could be recharged almost exclusively by braking and accelerating, which doesn't really make any sense. So the end result of this could be a car that never has to be recharged, so it could run perpetually.
That would be cool. And also impossible.
No charging from the grid, no assistance from gasoline, no cost of fueling up, no way, say the skeptics. Yeah, that's right, no way.
See, the story is a little extra tragic. This apparently is a 20-year obsession with this guy that broke up his marriage and lost him custody of his two young daughters. So it's, you know, it's like, damn, talk about having some blood invested in this.
That doesn't sound right. How do you lose custody of kids just because you're working on a machine of some kind?
Well, he hasn't made any money on it, so he can't pay child support.
Yeah, if you don't pay child support, judges get very mad at you.
And
they do things like take your
something else related sort of to that is that he's quoted here as saying, "I have mild dyslexia, don't do well in math, so he didn't do very well in school," hence, you know, college dropout and so forth. Steve, is dyslexia indicative of any other, perhaps, issues that a person might have? So it's independent, has nothing to do with perhaps his delusion.
It's an independent variable. It's just people who are at the very low end of the aptitude scale for reading.
Thank you for that clarification.
And that's it. And it's largely an independent variable. One wrinkle here that often comes up with these perpetual motion machines is that this was presented to a professor of engineering at MIT. This was Marcus Zahn. And he is quoted as saying, "It's hard for me to give an opinion. I don't believe it will violate
That's
the laws
opinion.
Of physics. You're not going to get more energy out than you put in."
Well,
so he's, you know, holding the line there.
Gave an
Good.
Opinion.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have an explanation for the apparent demonstration. He says it's an unusual phenomena I wouldn't have predicted in advance, but I saw it. It's real. Now I'm just trying to figure it out.
Which is perfectly okay to say, I don't know how it works yet. And yet, of course, the reporter takes that and runs the headline, "Perpetual motion.
Baffles scientists."
Right.
No idea.
And, so it's what he's saying in context and in isolation are perfectly legitimate, but it's just he's, I think, maybe naively allowing himself to be exploited to promote, kind of a soft sell on this on a perpetual motion machine. It's just all part of the con.
Yeah, scientists have to be really careful when they're replying to things like this, because they can very easily be taken out of context, as we see time and time again.
When I read it, I kind of got my hopes up. I was hoping that this engineering professor, Zahn, would immediately identify something that eluded this guy for 20 years.
Yeah.
And he wasn't immediately able to do it. But I think he eventually will figure out the mechanisms and what's going on. But of course, that will never, make the headlines. Zahn figures it out. Will be buried on page 7, column 3.
Probably, Bob, I think you're right. And I think that probably what scientists should do if they agree to examine these types of things is not say anything to the press until they've concluded investigation.
Right.
I'm looking at it. That's it. These preliminary comments, they may be innocent, but they cause a lot of harm. And you're right. The answer will be buried somewhere or not at all, because that's not news. Who cares? Oh, it's not perpetual motion?
Right.
That's not news.
Hey, speaking of devices that defy the second law of thermodynamics, I heard that Jay is in Sweden.
Yes, I heard that too.
I heard he took a ferry to Norway, so he's in Norway now.
The next news item, this is a quick and funny one. Voters are told pen had invisible ink is the headline. And what happened is, for background, yesterday was Super Tuesday, where almost half of the states in the United States voted in the primary elections to nominate the Democratic and Republican nominees for the general election in the fall. And at one voting location in Chicago, a couple of the citizens who were there to vote, I guess that they must have had the ballots where you fill in the little circle, like with a pen. The pen didn't work. It was dry. It was not making a mark. And one of the election staff, who somehow was misinformed themselves, got this notion in their head, told them that, oh, that's okay. That pen writes with invisible ink, but the machine can still read it. So like 20 voters used this dry pen to vote while it was making no mark on the paper, and they didn't actually vote. And they and that election staffer thought that it was writing in invisible ink.
Now, Steve, do you really think that they thought that person thought it was invisible ink, or do you think they were just being funny? Maybe.
The staffer?
Yeah, the staffer.
Yeah, that's you can't, you're not allowed to play jokes on voters. That's pretty bad form. The rule of thumb is always assume stupidity, and you're almost always going to be correct.
And didn't McCain lose by 19 votes in that state?
Careful.
Actually, McCain took Illinois, actually.
They didn't even mention, if it was, Democrat, Republican, or anything. But
there's always, cries of shenanigans when anything like that happens with the voting. But this was probably just misinformation.
So somebody really thinks that invisible ink was in that pen, that staffer.
Right.
Wow.
Now, the voters, just to be fair, this does not necessarily mean that they were dumb, that they believe this, to be honest with you. It's more just human psychology. If you're uncertain, if there's any uncertainty, you are very likely to acquiesce to an authority. So I think this says more about the human tendency, just to acquiesce to authority in an ambiguous situation, rather than that they were gullible or dumb. And one of them was quoted as saying that, it seemed odd to me. It didn't really make any sense, but that's what the person said. So their red flags went up, but not enough. They didn't have the confidence in themselves to say, wait a minute, this makes no sense. You know, is there somebody else up there I can talk to?
Or is there another pen I can have? Or
at least getting a second opinion.
Yeah, second opinion. Exactly. Huh. Right. I wonder if the polls were busy and they were being rushed through and they didn't, you know, then it's socially awkward to like make a stink. You know, I think this is more of a social phenomenon.
Maybe that authority was like a janitor came in and was just like, oh yeah, it's invisible ink.
That's one of them invisible ink pens. We got them in the back. The invisible man sold it to me.
Now, to be clear, this is not to say that invisible ink doesn't exist. Yeah, there are invisible inks that are not visible until they oxidize or are later exposed to something else. It's just the notion that you would use that in a voting situation is absurd. The next news item comes from Canada, and it seems that, unfortunately, Health Canada is authorizing the use by companies of making or healthcare claims for their products. So this is a new regulation that will go into effect on June 1st. And what they're doing is allowing the marketers of botanical supplements and vitamins to claim that their products actually can be useful in curing diseases, including cancer and heart disease and arthritis. Now, many countries' regulations, including the United States and previously Canada, and I'm pretty sure Australia is also the same way, do not allow disease claims without first being approved, you know, establishing that there's evidence of safety and effectiveness before you can make disease claims, and that seems reasonable. Some countries, like the United States, have a separate types of claims that they allow marketers to make. In the U.S., you can make what are called structure-function claims, which I think, you know, is just a wishy-washy way of making disease claims. I think it's actually a very bad regulation. So you could say, for example, that this, you know, boosts the immune system and helps it fight off cancer, but you can't say it cures cancer. Mm-hmm. So Canada is basically loosening their restrictions. They're broadening the claims they will allow manufacturers to make. This has the scientific community and the medical community in Canada a little bit up in arms that they think that this is going to result in the proliferation of a lot of misleading claims, and that it is going to either delay, you know, to more definitive treatment, or will, you know, cause harm to consumers by motivating them to rely upon dubious or unproven therapies. However, in their defense, Health Canada says that they are going to require the manufacturers or the sellers to provide evidence of efficacy to back up their claims, and that the more serious the disease that they're claiming to treat, the higher the threshold of evidence that they're going to require.
So the manufacturer, which is that independent verification, Steve, the manufacturers? The manufacturers just have to produce some kind of document saying, yeah, we tested it here, here, and here, and it's good.
I don't know. And they're vague on the details like that. I mean, that's the rub right there, Evan. The devil is in the details. How much evidence are they going to require? Is it going to have to be independent evidence? Is it going to have to be class one placebo-controlled clinical trials? And who's going to decide? You know, are they going to? Is it going to be case by case? Are they just going to wing it, or are they going to have very specific guidelines? And if it actually is a system where they do require high quality evidence before the claims are being made, that's actually fine. I have no problem with that. I actually think that's, if that's true, that would actually even be better than our system.
You think that's what's going to happen, though?
Well, if that's the case, then I'm not sure why the medical community and the scientists are up in arms about it. I think it's because they suspect that it's not going to be the kind of protection that they think is necessary.
Right, it's going to be the homeopaths putting out their homeopathic stuff, tested by homeopaths, approved by homeopaths, and you know, what good is that? Nothing.
That's the concern. Yeah. That's the concern, right. And unfortunately, it seems to be the way things are going more in general, that, you know, loosening of regulations in the guise of healthcare freedom, when in fact it's just anti-consumer way of giving corporations more power to, you know, make claims without requiring evidence.
Did they say why Canada is taking this step? Was there a referendum or something that the people voted on?
No, there was no referendum or anything. It's usually this is the kind of thing that's usually done by just a few advocates pushing it through under the radar. You know,
this is awful.
Well, if any of our listeners up in Canada have any more information about it, let us know. We'll follow the story as it develops. Let's go on to your questions in email. The first question is a follow-up from last week. This one comes from Scott Hamilton from St. Petersburg. And Scott writes, "Hello, guys. Love the show. I just wanted to help clarify one point about organic milk, which Steve said costs twice as much for no real reason. Milk that's labeled organic from most brands you'll find in a grocery store may be organic, but the real reason it tastes better and has a much, much longer shelf life is because it's been through a process called UHT, or ultra-high temperature processing. Apparently, people get freaked out if they're told they don't have to refrigerate their milk until they open it. So the companies have hit on using the fashionable organic label to obscure the fact that the UHT nature of the product is what actually makes it special." Well, thanks, Scott, for that information. Several of our listeners emailed us or wrote on the boards. Last week, we talked about organic milk and raw milk, and we were asked the question, is it true that organic milk has a longer shelf life than regular milk? And in the time I had to prep for the show last week, I didn't find anything about that. But apparently, a lot of organic milk undergoes what's called ultra-pasteurization or ultra-high-temperature pasteurization. They pasteurize it at a higher temperature in order to kill more of the bacteria. They do this specifically to give it a longer shelf life. And the reason why they do that is because organic milk doesn't sell as quickly as regular milk, so it needs a longer shelf life because it's probably going to hang out in the store longer. But of course, if you buy it, you know, relatively fresh or soon after it's put on the shelf, it's going to last longer than regular milk, which had the normal pasteurization process. So that appears to be the answer to that little mystery, which we did not hit upon last week. The next email comes from Pete Lebzowski from Delaware, and Pete writes, "Hey all, I was in a bookstore the other day and was bewildered to see an entire display devoted to books about the coming apocalypse in the year 2012. I'd heard before that the Mayan calendar ends in 2012, and for some reason this is supposed to signal the end of the world. But just from skimming over the titles of these books, I can't make out what exactly is supposed to happen then. One book says that the Mayan god Quetzalcoatl will return. Another says that the magnetic poles will suddenly shift. Then, earlier today, I came across a message board post on Amazon.com in which a woman stated that she watched a 2012 apocalypse show on the Discovery Channel and was terrified for the well-being of her children. She has apparently lost a lot of sleep over it. Of course, this whole thing is nonsense, but I have some superstitious friends who I know will buy into the doomsday predictions, and a simple it's all hooey from me won't stop them from losing sleep like the poor message board poster. Do you guys know any more about the origins, history of this latest apocalypse craze?" Well, Bob, I think you know a little bit more about it.
I did some research on it. I've been hearing a lot about this 2012 apocalypse. It's getting really annoying. Like our emailer said, there have been books written. It's been on the news a lot. And my favorite, of course, are those websites with flashing multicolored text all in caps, which I've been reading. Like, boy, I swear I had a little seizure after reading a few of those websites. The deal is the world's going to end 2012. It's another Y2K, this time not caused by computers but by a calendar. The Mayan civilization, which this is all based on, had two different calendars. They had an annual, pretty much it was an annual calendar that we would kind of recognize. They had another calendar, though, that kept track of longer periods of time. This is called the Long Count Calendar and covered 5,125 years. And most Mayan scholars agree that the calendar started, you know, probably on Jay's birthday in 3114 BC or BCE and August 11th. And if this is true, then this long cycle will end December 12th, 2012, just a few years away.
12-12-12?
Yeah, right. Must be something to that. Many people now seem to believe that since the calendar is ending, then the world must also end. Seems a reasonable extrapolation to me.
I guess
these are the kind of people that get a little nervous when they rip out that last page of their desk calendar at work until they buy the new one. Now, these people have latched on to any prediction or prophecy or anything that seems to point to something nasty maybe happening in the somewhat near future, such as, reversal of the magnetic poles. Now, the magnetic poles of the Earth have reversed in history. They have identified that that has happened, but they believe it's there's many hundreds of thousands of years between the interval between the reversals, and it's not something that happens very fast, and we have no idea if and when it's going to happen again. But of course, a lot of people think that it's going to be happening now in 2012.
Now, as an aside, from what I understand, if and when the magnetic poles do shift, that's actually a bad thing for us.
That's pretty bad. It actually is, yeah. Because the if that shuts down our magnetosphere, which protects us from all sorts of nasty cosmic rays and ultraviolet radiation. Well, wait, does it protect us from ultraviolet, or is that's primarily the ozone? But no,
that's primarily the ozone. Cosmic rays protect us from a lot of the solar wind and cosmic rays and whatnot.
Absolutely, that would be a very bad thing, and it is a little scary, but. That could be many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years in the future. There's nothing that's pointing to something that is going to happen within any of our lifetimes.
But so, also wipe out all of our satellite communications.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Because essentially there would be a period of time when it's in the midst of shifting. And if I recall, the estimates that they've had is that maybe for hundreds or even a couple of thousand years, there would be no effective magnetosphere until it realigns itself, on its new axis.
Right. So that is definitely a scary thing, but nothing that we need to worry about.
Yeah, we'll be hit by an asteroid long before that happens.
Yeah, right. Some people think that time frame, 2012, is going to be when we reach our global peak in energy production, which of course is going to, once we go on the downslide of energy production and realize that, hey, we really are running out of oil and things like that, that's going to cause all sorts of chaos. But yet again,
we'll be on solar by then.
Yeah, this is something that has been debated for many, many years, and we really don't know when peak energy production is going to happen. It could be 50 or more years away. So I don't think there's any great arguments that that's going to happen within a few years. Another one, which I found pretty interesting, this one said that technological creation of smarter than human intelligence, making computers a source of invention. In a theory known as a singularity. The singularity is going to happen in 4 years. I don't think so. And if it does, cool. I'm not worried.
Could be at least 5 or 6 years.
And also, here's another good one. People are saying that Nostradamus, of course, Nostradamus predicted this. And God, they're all over the map with this guy. But the only substantive quote I could find doesn't even talk about 2012. He's talking about 1999. So they're kind of taking one of his quotes that I think he might actually explicitly mention that year. Mm-hmm. They're totally twisting that to think that, he meant 2012 kind of thing. So that's kind of wacky.
Yeah.
So they're just latching onto everything. I've got one good quote here from Keith Prufer, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Mexico. He said of the calendars, the end of the calendar's long cycle does not imply an apocalypse, but rather an anniversary similar to the millennium, though for a period of more than 5,000 years. It's not the end of the world, he said. And there does not seem to be any organized group built around this belief, so I'm not sure how
there's no cult or something?
Yeah, not yet anyway, so I'm not sure how organized they're going to get and how widespread this belief is going to be. But we'll see, how out of hand this gets.
I guess no matter how many times the doomsayers predict the end of the world and it doesn't happen, there'll always be some other bunch of crackpots the next time the slightest provocation comes around. Let's do one more email before we do our interview. This one comes from Lauren Evans from Tampa, Florida. And Lauren writes, first, I would like to say thanks for the great show. My girlfriend and I listen together every week. She nailed the piezoelectric mechanism for the rain generator in Science or Fiction last week. We are both big fans. I am a young researcher in training and feel your podcast has really helped me develop a sense of logical evaluation useful in the lab and at home. I have a question about the plausibility of SETI, that's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I agree with the philosophy of the program. You can't hear a signal if you don't listen, but I don't know if it's possible. A special on the History Channel about Earth after people claim that Earth's transmissions would fade into noise after they have traveled 1 to 2 light years. From what I know about radio signals, this seems likely. If this is true for us, wouldn't that also be true for any other radio-capable society out in the universe? Does that mean SETI is wasting their time listening, or is there more to this than I currently understand? This seems like a J question to me. Thanks again for the great program. I look forward to it every week. And P.S., the skeptic rocks hard.
Yeah. Oh, I like this guy.
Yeah, that was your prediction, wasn't it? That you were going to rock
hard? I think
hard
it was.
Yeah.
No, that was merely my resolution.
Resolution.
I'm living up to it.
Okay. Well, this is, you know, half right, half wrong. It's certainly true that radio signals will fade away over distance. They follow the inverse square law. So for every time they double how far out they go, they are one quarter as strong. You know, but doing calculations based upon, for example, our earthly transmissions, that assumes that the signals are just going in all directions non-specifically, leaking out into space. The same would not be true if you produced a focused beam. The energy that you put in would get you much greater distance. You know, if you're trying to transmit in all directions at the same time, that takes a tremendous amount of energy. And the SETI scientists have, you know, done the calculations, and you could say, well, how much energy would a civilization have to be putting into their radio transmitter at what distance in order for us to be able to pick it up? And yeah, it is a lot. I do think that is one of the limiting factors, but it doesn't mean that it's impossible or that it's a waste of time. Either there needs to be a civilization that has been that just has a really powerful generator. I mean, you know, many, 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 many times more powerful, orders of magnitude more powerful than the amount of energy just in our radio and TV signals, or they need to be pointing it at us for whatever reason. That seems less likely, you know, unless they have multiple radio generators pointing them in many, many different directions, and or for some reason, you know, they know what kinds of stars are likely to have planets with life on them, and they're targeting those kinds of stars or whatever. Also, you know, you could always hypothesize some kind of technology that have not thought of yet that they could be using in order to get their signals more powerful and to go more far. So, yeah, a lot of unknowns. It's very difficult, but it's not impossible. It's not as if it's not possible for us to be being bathed in the radio waves from an extraterrestrial civilization.
Yeah, it's definitely not a deal killer for SETI. But just one quick thing, Evan, I wanted to say, Steve. One thing that's disappointing, and I remember reading this, although I haven't read it, you know, I haven't read this recently in different places, but I remember reading once, I forget where, that it is true that our TV signals do attenuate pretty much into static at a certain distance. And I think a lot of people like to think that there's some alien kind of lounging back, you know, watching I Love Lucy and stuff. But you get to a certain distance and it would be next to impossible to reconstitute a signal and make any sense out of it at all. So they're really not going to be watching TV, alien civilizations, you know, within 10, 20, or 30 light years. It's really just not going to happen.
Well, you guys know what NASA did this week, right?
Yeah, Beatles song, yep.
Yeah, they beamed the Beatles song across the universe using the Deep Space Network, a network of antennas, to transmit that Beatles song to the North Star, Polaris, 431 light years away from Earth.
Right.
And I guess Polaris. If there was a civilization that they'd have to know how to extrapolate the signal, you know, turn it back into music effectively and listen to it. But, you know, certainly with a focused effort of the technology that is available, it is possible to send these direct messages into space.
And we've beamed messages into space in the past. NASA has. And I believe in the 80s or sometime 10 or 20 years ago, they pointed the antenna at a globular cluster. So that way they could target, you know, a lot
stars.
Of stars that are all very tightly clustered together at the same time.
Did you hear what Paul McCartney said in a message to NASA? Send my love to the aliens. All the best, Paul.
Oh, God. But why did they send the Beatles? Didn't the aliens request Chuck Berry?
Yeah, send more Chuck Berry.
What was that joke from?
Saturday Night Live.
Oh,
it's an old one.
All right.
Well, let's go on to the interview. Joining us now is Rich Hayes. Rich, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And Rich is the Deputy Director of Communications for the Union of Concerned Scientists and lead author on their new book, A Scientist's Guide to Talking with the Media. So, Rich, why don't you first start out by telling us a little bit about the Union of Concerned Scientists?
You bet. UCS, the Union of Concerned Scientists, we were actually formed in 1969 at MIT when a group of scientists and students got together, and since then we've grown into the nation's leading science-based nonprofit, weighing in on a range of environmental and security issues. So a large part of what we do is help translate science for policymakers, for the media, for the general public. So we've got offices around the country, and actually our head office, HQ is just down the road from Rebecca there in Boston.
I'll have to make my pilgrimage one of these days.
So you're primarily a politically active group trying to advocate for specific policies in Washington?
Yeah, we advocate on a number of different policies where science is at the core. So a big one that we've taken on in the last couple of years is the political interference of science. So we organized the big statement with 52 Nobel laureates and 63 National Medal of Science winners. Folks like Lawrence Krauss, I think, who was on your show recently,
and
brought them together to really call out the administration on their abuses of science. So we work on a number of other issues as well, climate change, energy policy, biotechnology, things like that.
Let's talk a little bit about the book first. You know, thank you for sending me a free copy of the book, by the way. I did finish reading it, and I thought it was a very, very useful guide. It's basically a handbook for a scientist on how to interface with the media, all the way from just talking briefly about their research to being what you call a celebrity scientist. And you said you were the lead author on that book, correct?
That's right, yeah, with Dan Grossman. And Dan is a former NPR reporter, producer. You might have recognized his name from Living on Earth. And he's been a science journalist for over 20 years. And maybe you've seen his byline in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, places like that. And so what we really did for the book is we drew on our own experiences. I've been a reporter for, was a reporter for 3 years or so before I came to the Union of Concerned Scientists. And I've been here about 15 years working with scientists from universities around the country. And really, you know, in our work together, you know, working with scientists over the years, we heard over and over again what a hard time scientists are having communicating to the media.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard so many complaints about the media and how they cover their research. And, you know, this has been going on for a very, very long time. And so we felt, you know, let's do something about this. Let's produce a guide that can help them. And, you know, it has to happen. You know, scientists, you know, they must become better communicators, you know, in the service of science, in the service of accuracy, and in the for the public good.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think you made the point very well in the book that, you know, it's one thing just to complain about the media, but the fact is that they can be our friends if you just know how to interface with them. So you actually put the onus on the scientists. You know, this is what you can do to make the interaction more successful.
That's right. And in a way that we could have called the book, you know, What Would Carl Do? As in, you know, Carl Sagan Do. You know, part of that is understanding how the media works. And that's, in a way, the first step is realizing that, you know, reporters, you know, they're professionals. You know, they care deeply about the quality of their work, at least most of them do, but there are exceptions. You know what the exceptions are. But, you know, they work under really, really tight deadlines. They often have only a day or so to get up to speed on issues that scientists have dedicated their career to. You know, so scientists expect them to be experts, you know. That's sort of step number one. And the other piece of that is, you know, there's huge contracting going on right now in the media, especially in newspapers and magazines. You know, there's layoffs. So these reporters who are covering the science beat, they're being stretched more thin than ever before. I mean, Juliet Alperin, she covers climate change for the Washington Post. She's been covering the campaign, the primaries for the last several months. So really a big challenge. But, you know, the good news is that, you know, despite the public's low level of scientific literacy, and I hope we can go into that a little bit. But despite, you know, the challenges, know, the scientific community is held in very high regard by the public, more so than, you know, politicians and athletes, celebrities, you know, the list goes on and on. So, you know, over the last 35 years, this is according to the National Science Foundation, the scientific community is really one of the public's most trusted institutions. So scientists, they've got this wealth of capital. They just need to know how to use it. So that's really what our book is about. How do you use that capital to be effective with the media?
And you recounted some cautionary tales, some situations in which scientists, really just because they were naive about how to interface with the media, manufactured some pretty bad gaffes. Are there any of those stories that stick out for you?
Well, one of the things we did for our book, I should say that we you know, interviewed a lot of reporters, a lot of editors, scientists from around the country, and we actually conducted a survey of scientists. And you know, it was really interesting to hear what they said, because they had a lot of complaints about the media, and a lot of them were completely legitimate. Things like being misquoted, having their research taken out of context, having their research sensationalized, you know, all very serious problems that our book really is trying to address. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the other complaints that we heard would fall into, I'd put it more into the category of errors of omission. So there was one scientist who I will not name, who complained that after they'd written a several hundred page report, they were upset that, you know, my God, the New York Times, you know, did a 700 word story and only focused on a couple points. So that was their complaint. You know, that's really what the media does. So kind of hard, more not understanding how the media works. You know, another scientist complained that they had done this study and there were, you know, seven other scientists from different institutions who had been part of the research, but only one of the scientists got mentioned. Only one of the institutions got mentioned. So really more of an error of omission. So, you know, what we want to do is, you know, want to set up realistic expectations. So if you have realistic expectations about what the media can and cannot do, you know, then you can start to do these things where scientists can be more effective. So, you know, so what should they do? I mean, what should they do? You know, how do you be like Carl? Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing is, you know, and to me, it's the main message of our book is, you know, that we don't have to dumb down issues for the press. That is the one thing we have heard over and over, over all the years working with scientists. They've heard, oh my God, you know, I don't have to dumb down issues for the media. I don't want to have to dumb down issues for the general public. Well, we don't have to dumb down issues for the media, but there's this great thing that we quote in our book, that we can be simple without being simplistic. And again, I think Carl Sagan is this great example how to be simple without being simplistic. And actually, there's a great quote from Paula Roque. This is a little bit like that Einstein quote we've all heard. But she said, you know, one hallmark of intellect is the ability to simplify, to make the complex easy to understand, that anyone can be unclear. So, you know, but the thing is, it's really important to know that, you know, it's easy to tell a scientist, you know, hey, you got to be simple without being simplistic. You know, be like Carl Sagan, but if you're immersed in research, and you've got a very technical report you're getting across, really complicated scientific information, how do you go about doing that? And so that's where we really break it down and try and help them. And, you know, the first point of that is they need to have those three or four key messages that they want to get across. This is not you know, like they're in the classroom where they can just talk about anything over 45 minutes. They need to have those three or four key messages. And then one of the things that we came up with for our book to help them be disciplined about how they get those messages across, something that we call the message compass. The basic idea here is whatever direction an interview goes, you know, you always know the key points that you want to emphasize. So every point on that message compass is a key point. So you always know where it want to go. So really important to be disciplined and gets to the idea of taking control of interviews. Scientists need to advocate their research and take control of interviews.
Now, I think also scientists need to do this a lot because the interface with the media, you know, just even personally, I find that it's very easy to lose sense of what the public commonly knows, you know, what's likely to be something that the average person would know. And you get so immersed in your own subspecialty that, you know, just you can't look back and remember what it was like not to be an expert, you know, in that field. So if you're not constantly interfacing with the public or the media and getting the feedback and knowing where to adjust your message, as you say, how to make it understandable, you're just not going to be good at it. It's a skill like anything else.
Absolutely. You have to practice. But, you know, the thing is, you can practice this, you know, with your students. You can practice it over Thanksgiving dinner of how to speak simply without being simplistic. I mean, part of what we recommend to scientists is when they're doing an interview, you know, imagine that they are talking to, you know, a family member very far removed from their work, you know, someone who doesn't know science. How would they talk to that person, you know, who's a lawyer or financial planner or whatever they do? You know, smart people, again, don't have to dumb it down, but how would they talk to that person? And really important to know that, you know, the repetition is really important. You have to be creating a drumbeat in the media. You know, it takes 5 to 7 impressions for the public to finally start to remember something. So you do need to use all the tools at one's disposal. And one of the things we talk about in our book is, you know, what are all the different ways that scientists can get out there? And one of the most old-fashioned ways, and you kind of allude to it, is reporters and scientists, they need to talk more outside the pressures of a daily news deadline. Now, they got to talk. I mean, there's a great quote from Andy Revkin. He's a science reporter from the New York Times. He says, if we're ever going to, you know, solve these problems, I'm paraphrasing, but if we're ever going to solve these major problems facing the country, and, you know, whether it be intelligent design or climate change, you know, these, whatever it is that science is involved, you know, we need to have scientists and reporters talking outside the pressures of a daily news deadline. But one of the things that was interesting interviewing reporters for the book is that they told us over and over again that they rarely hear from scientists directly. They get calls from public information officers at universities, from, you know, PR firms, from industry groups, from government public affairs people, but rarely from scientists directly, which is amazing. You would think that these scientists would actually want to be calling reporters for their research, but, you know, there is this habit that they've gotten into partly because of PR people, so I don't want to pick on PR people, but, you know, I actually believe that sometimes those folks need to get out of the way. Scientists need to call up reporters directly. It can develop those relationships outside the pressures of a daily news deadline, and so many reasons to do this, because then you can have those conversations about, you know, the issues. In the meantime, as they're doing this, the scientist is becoming a source, become an on-call expert for quotes, you know, balance and steer coverage. You know, if there's some new paranormal thing, you know, the scientist can get a phone call and say, you know, there's nothing to this. There's no basis in this.
Right.
So to let them know that, you know, listen, there's no controversy in the scientific community. There's absolutely no scientific fact that backs this up. And, you know, this is so important because, you know, one of the great things about your show is really debunking, you know, some of these pseudoscientific beliefs out there. And, you know, 28% of the public believes in astrology. You know, 35% believes that houses can be haunted. 50% believe in some form of ESP. You know, it's just a sorry state of affairs. So, you know, if we're going to solve these major issues, if we're going to make sure that evolution is taught in our schools, if we're going to make sure that the best science comes to bear on issues like stem cell research, scientists have to be better communicators.
Yeah, again, I totally agree with that. Although I also think, and you are fair about this, that the media, it's a two-way street, you know, and the media also has a role to play. And there are some times when, you know, the problem with the story is not the scientist's fault. And I think that primarily happens when the media or the journalist has the story already. They know what story they want to tell, and then they're just, you know, mining for quotes they could plug in to their story. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of reporters, they look for conflict and make the story more interesting, but it's all the more reason to take control of interviews. And so it is possible that, you know, that a reporter can call a scientist with a soundbite or a quote that they would really like the scientist to put in there. And so they lead the scientist towards that. And that's where the scientists really have to be aware of what's happening and sort of say, you know, this is what I really want to say. And then as part of that, say, you know, make the case. You know, I just want to make sure, you know, I that there is no scientific debate on this. There is no science to back up this paranormal claim, whatever it is. The other thing a scientist can do is, you know, when the interview is over, say, you know, I really suggest that you talk to, you know, Dr. X at MIT or Dr. So-and-so at Stanford or the University of Michigan, wherever it is. You know, another thing that scientists can do is say, listen, you know, I know there's some complicated information in this story. I'd be happy to take a look at some of the real technical pieces just for accuracy. Mm-hmm. Now, it was interesting talking to some reporters that we interviewed for the book. You know, not all of them said that they would do this, but, you know, many said they would. So as long as the scientists ask and puts it out there in a, you know, a friendly, you know, way, you know, a lot of reporters will take the scientist up on that.
Yeah, I don't know why they wouldn't, you know, be excited to have somebody else do some of their work for them. You know, basically
absolutely.
Some quality control.
Right, that's right. However, there are some reporters and some papers that feel it's more of an ethical issue, that no, you know, the sources, it's not their role to fact check. So they some reporters will draw a harder line, but really many, they want to get their stories right. Again, you know, these are professionals. Why not ask? You know, just take that extra step.
This is a bit tangential, but what do you think about the notion of framing, of like framing scientific stories that has been advocated by Matthew Nisbet and others?
Yeah, well, you know, in some ways, work that they've done, I think it's very, very good work. And I agree with most of what they're saying. In our book, we talk about framing, but in a little different way. We have a section that I'll just, for this conversation, call it the science of soundbites. And it's talking about how soundbites are a really important way to get scientific messages out to the public. And when I talk about soundbites, I'm not talking about soundbites that we hear from politicians. You know, it's not, you know, spin, and it's not obfuscation. It's not the soundbites that we heard after the Super Bowl. You know, those hackneyed expressions.
Right.
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about ways to communicate complicated information in a way that will resonate with the public, that will open up the issue, that will frame it in a way that the public will understand it, they'll remember, but also that reporters will find useful, because reporters, they need soundbites. So one of the things we did for our book is we analyzed hundreds of different newspaper articles, magazine articles, print, radio and television interviews to get a sense of what are the sound bites that are working effectively for scientists. You know, what works well for scientists? And then we asked reporters as well, you know, what kind of sound bites do you like from scientists? And so we put these into different categories. They were things like using analogies and metaphors and using emotions when it makes sense to get a message across, painting these pictures, to use cliches. And, you know, the favorite soundbite style that we have in our book, we called it an astute quip. And to me, these are the most memorable soundbites because they often seem like off-the-cuff one-liners. I mean, to me, a great example of this is Mike Brown. He's an astrophysicist at Caltech. And you all, of course, remember this whole controversy over Pluto in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Is Pluto a planet or not? Is it a dwarf planet? Should we increase the number of planets to include these dwarf planets? So Dr. Brown was asked about the 12-planet solution for Pluto, and he called it a no-ice-ball-left-behind policy. So this was picked up in scores of media outlets across the country. It was the quote of the week in Time magazine. So to me, it just goes to show what a really effective soundbite can do. And one of the things that we make clear in our book is, you know, we don't want scientists peppering, you know, having one soundbite after another. You know, that's not what we're talking about here. We want scientists to go into the substance, to go into the detail, but just having a couple sound bites, just a couple, that help frame the issue in a way that the public is going to find useful, and again, will resonate. And so, I really do think the work of the framing work that Nisbet and Mooney are doing is really important.
I don't remember how much you went into this in the book. I think you just touched on it towards the end. But what do you also think about scientists not only interfacing with journalists, but essentially becoming journalists themselves by, you know, with the internet now, especially, you know, the option of bypassing the media and going directly to the public is actually very viable. In fact, that's, you know, it's what we do, right? So what do you think about that role and everything?
I think it's tremendously important. I think you're doing a great service. So I would encourage more scientists to do that, to go directly to the public any way they can. Again, volume matters, and especially in this age of the internet where information is coming from so many different sources, you know, scientists have to be speaking up. If they're not speaking up on these issues, know, on the evolution intelligent design debate, you know, who's going to speak up? Well, we know the answer.
Yeah, the cranks and the ideologues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So scientists have to be stepping up, and the blog's a great tool. You know, one of the things we talked about in our book is letters to the editor. People, scientists often overlook LTEs, letters to the editor, you know, because, oh, you know, it's just, that's what other people do. Well, the LTE page is one of the most read sections of a newspaper. So right there, that's a reason that scientists should write more LTEs. Another reason, members of staff of legislators, you know, they monitor the LTE page every day. So it's a great way to reach decision makers directly. Mm-hmm. LTEs at larger newspapers, they end up in these databases, you know, the Nexus database, they end up being found online. So, again, all adds to this drumbeat. So need to use every tool. Scientists need to use every tool at their disposal to reach out. So blogs, definitely another great way. Talk radio. You know, I strongly believe we can't just feed the debate over scientific issues to folks who are, you know, talking to each other in this little echo chamber. So, you know, if to the scientists on the call, and actually to the non-scientists who are listening to the show, you know, call in. You know, if Glenn Beck is saying something that's just factually wrong, scientifically inaccurate, and there's a call-in, call in. You know, if Larry King has a host, it has a guest who's talking about something that is scientifically inaccurate, call in. So we need to be reaching out every way we can. It makes such a difference.
Boy, Rich, you know, you just mentioned a couple names there. I would argue that it would be hard to... A much shorter list would be people who host these national shows who actually do get it, and you don't have to call in and make these kind of corrections to these people. The one person who comes to mind is Dr. Dean Adel. I love listening to his show. I learn so much, and he gets the science right 99.99% of the time.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, this is where if scientists are taking the time to meet some of these folks outside the pressures of a daily, you know, deadline, they can help educate. So Dr. Dean Adel, fabulous example. We need more of these folks. And, you know, the good news is, another good news here is that there are more science journalism programs at universities around the country. Folks in the media world, they are aware of this problem. They do know that part of this, the bad coverage of scientists, of science over the years is partly the media's fault. And so they're doing some things to remedy it. But again, there's so much that scientists can do in the service of accuracy and the public good. And so that's really what we're encouraging folks to do with this book.
And you talk about in the book something that I've also heard elsewhere, that the part of the problem, at least historically, was that within science there was this culture that popularizing science or dealing directly with the public was somehow unseemly and tainted and vulgar. And that even Carl Sagan, you know, who, you know, many put forward as the paragon of, again, sort of the scientist educator, you know, the person who popularizes science to the public very effectively, that it tainted him and his career in the eyes of his colleagues as well. How far do you think we've come in sort of changing those attitudes within science?
I think we've come a long way. I think scientists now realize how important Carl Sagan was.
Mm-hmm.
The chairman of our board, Kurt Gottfried, is a very well-renowned physicist, and he's at Cornell. He's a professor emeritus of physics there. And you know, he told me, you know, back when Dr. Sagan was doing his work, how many of, you know, his colleagues there, you know, were just tearing Dr. Sagan down for what he was doing. But, you know, I think more and more scientists now realize that if they are not speaking up, that other folks are going to be speaking up. So we've got new folks like Lawrence Krauss. Henry Kendall was one of our founders. He won a Nobel for discovery of quarks. He was very much of a civic scientist. This is what Neil Lane at... former head of the National Science Foundation. He's at Rice University now, but he really has called for, you know, more of these civic scientists. You know, folks like Steven Snyder, you know, even, you know, Bill Nye the Science Guy,
mm-hmm.
doing great work to popularize science and help the public realize, you know, what a large role science plays in our lives. And if we don't understand some of these basic constructs of science, you know, the bad decisions that can come away from that. So. So we're really part of what the Union of Concerned Scientists does is find ways to bring scientists together at universities from other think tanks to give them a means to speak out, both to the media and to policymakers, because we really feel like it's critically important for them to be getting engaged.
Now, you said earlier that you wanted to talk about the problem of scientific illiteracy in our society. Is that a topic that the UCS specifically addresses? And is, and again, how do, what responsibility do you think like the average working scientist has towards this problem of public scientific illiteracy?
You know, we don't do it directly, but we do it indirectly through all of our work. So one of the things that we do is, you know, we have a staff of former reporters who work in our organization, folks like Aaron Hurtis and Elliot Nagin and Emily Robinson. These folks have worked at, you know, Blair NewsHour and American Journalism Review and worked with scientists. So what they do is, you know, whenever we have a scientific issue, you know, they work to explain it in a way the public can understand. So, you know, I feel like every scientist has an obligation to, again, it's not going to happen with just Lawrence Krauss alone doing it. It's not going to be enough with Len Fisher, who we talk about in our book, doing it. It's not going to be enough for David Grinspoon doing it. You know, we need scientists all across the country on whatever the issue it is that they work on, because even if they work on something really arcane, just finding ways to make it more resonant, understandable to the public, can help the public on so many different issues, again, from stem cell research to climate change to evolution. So important.
But yeah, I agree. Although I think with the scientific illiteracy problem, that just the educational system plays such a huge role. It's almost like, you know, the scientific community and, you know, scientific popularizers can play a role in, you know, like doing some damage control and maybe compensating for it somewhat or filling in the deficiencies. But it's going to be hard to have a major impact when just the basic education system is so deficient in how it teaches science.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I hope I didn't give the impression that it's going to solve it. Scientists alone can solve it. It's going to take, you're right, it's going to take educators and a major push to increase the and improve the way science is taught in our schools. Most of what we're talking about in our book, it's easy for scientists to do if they just make it a goal and start doing it more frequently. So
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it can have such a huge impact. I mean, just from one point, I don't know that I know of any scientists that were not inspired early on in their life or in their career by some, you know, science popularizer. There was some scientist who was prominent or in the media that you know, gave them their love for science, you know?
That's right. Yep. And I know, I mean, just working with scientists here, who inspired them? So again, I think if more scientists can take that role, you know, what would Carl do? Well, we know what he would do. He would be out there right now debunking these claims. He would be out there advocating for better science. So hopefully, you know, more scientists will get involved. And again, to your listeners who aren't scientists, you know, I really strongly believe that they can play a role too. And listening to this show is one thing, to all your great podcasts, but if they can be writing letters to the editors, if they can be calling into talk shows, if they can just be adding to this drumbeat, you know, it'll all help. It'll all help make it difference. You know, and the thing is, media outlets, they hear all the time from the folks that have a very different agenda.
Because you're right, they know how to use the media. Like the intelligent design proponents, those guys, but they absolutely know how to use the media. They're very savvy at that. So it's almost like we're playing catch-up, you know, with the pseudoscientists.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things that a reporter at the New Orleans Times-Picayune told us was that, you know, if I ever get something wrong in a story, I hear immediately from industry. I hear immediately from some of the crankpots, but I don't get those immediate calls from scientists correcting me. And if an error is really egregious, you know, those other folks, they climb the ladder in the media outlet. They go to the person's editor or the person's boss. They climb it, and all that, you know, is another way of influencing the media and what they're going to be covering. So, if the general public, if your listeners aren't clamoring, you know, more frequently and more loudly for better science news, we might as well just pack it in right now. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think more scientists are getting involved. And again, scientists have this tremendous amount of capital that they can use. They are one of the most trusted institutions in this society. They just need to know how to use it.
Well, Rich, thank you very much for joining us. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you. I have to say, your show is fabulous, and you really do have a fan club over here.
Oh, is that right?
So, yeah, I really do. And,
cool.
So thank you for all you're doing, and you know, really appreciate the opportunity. So,
well, thank you. It's good to hear.
Yeah.
All right, take care.
It makes a difference. Okay, take care.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and you can play along at home. We have an unusual theme this week. This week, the theme is the blast from the past. And I took this from a suggestion from a listener. And what I did was I pulled three science or fiction items from past episodes.
Oh,
not recent past episodes. Two are real, one is fake, just as they were presented to you in the past. Well, and so this will also be a test for your memory. So we'll see how you guys do. Ready?
Yeah. The thing is, do you remember your incorrect choice, or do you remember the answer?
That's right.
That's right.
All right. Here we go. Number one, researchers have restored sight to blind mice by transplanting stem cells into their eyes. Item number two, a new study shows that daily flossing is associated with lower scores on standard IQ tests. And item number three, Georgia Tech researchers have developed a fuel combustion engine that produces almost zero emissions.
Wow. So you're saying we've seen all these before?
That's right.
Oh, jeez.
Bob, why don't you go first?
Oh, you bastard. Researchers have restored sight to blind mice by transplanting stem cells into their eyes. Well, yeah, I could see that. Stem cells can do anything. New study shows daily flossing is lower. That one rings a bell, but of course I have no idea whether it was the correct one or I'm just not buying that one. Georgia Tech researchers have developed a fuel combustion engine, almost zero emissions. Yeah, I mean, what kind of fuel? And it might work in the lab, but it might be totally impractical. So I guess that's possible, too. Daily flossing. I'm going to say that is fiction.
All right, Rebecca?
Yeah, that's the only one that doesn't even ring a bell with me. So I'm just going to take a stab and say that that's fiction as well.
All righty, Evan?
Yep, that was my first impression too, recollection I should say, is that one was fiction. So I'm right there with them.
All right, so we might as well take these in order. You all agree that researchers have restored sight to blind mice by transplanting stem cells into their eyes, and that one was and is science.
Yay!
This is a news item from November 8th, 2006.
Seriously, Steve, 2 years ago, you're pulling this stuff out?
Oh, yeah.
I like this.
UK scientists treated animals which had eye damage similar to that seen in many human eye diseases. And this is published in Nature at that time, saying it was stunning research. And these things always take years to pan out, but this was a very encouraging, very early use or early research into an actual clinical application for stem cells. This was even before the recent stem cell developments.
Just thinking 2 years. I mean, well, a year and a half. The developments in the news about stem cells that has happened since then. A lot. Quite a bit.
Yeah, well, are they on to the next phase of research?
I assume. I mean, these things are usually don't come out of the blue. They're part of a research program, you know?
Right.
You have a grant to do this kind of thing for years.
Scientists don't get blindsided by something like this.
Oh,
that's right.
Nice one.
Blindsided. That was
it was a little funny.
Last time there were a couple of jokes about three blind mice. That's okay. You guys missed it this time around.
Oh. Yeah, well, I wasn't going to go back there.
So little is too obvious for Evan.
Right. Thanks.
I think it was Evan's joke last time, actually.
Woo-hoo.
All right.
No I'm
doubt.
Two for two.
Item number two. New study shows that daily flossing is associated with lower scores on standard IQ tests. And that one was and is fiction.
Yoo-hoo! Oh.
I didn't get you last time on that one either.
Why are you trying to discourage us from flossing, Steve? Repeat.
I'm a shill for the Dental Association.
How old is this one?
August 1st, 2006 also, so again about a year and a half. And this was based upon a study that was study looking at the negative effects of not flossing, which are not surprising, like gingival bleeding and halitosis, poor oral hygiene. It can also lead to cardiac disease because you have more bacterial problems.
Wow.
Flossing is good for you. Which means that, item number three, Georgia Tech researchers have developed a fuel combustion engine that produces almost zero emissions, is also science. This story comes from June 21st, 2006. So this was an interesting breakthrough. It's basically a ultra-low emission engine cycle. You know, they use a combustor. This is what, at the time, what they said, the researchers. Our combustor has an unbelievably simple design, and it would be inexpensive to make and inexpensive to maintain.
Let's get going on that, then.
Yeah, the key for this one was of a low-temperature combustion process.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. We want to have the all-clean-burning advantages of a low-temperature combustion process while burning a large amount of fuel in a small volume. Well, congratulations, everyone.
Thanks, Doc.
Again.
I did fill in for Jay, though, with the quote this week.
Oh, good.
Cool.
I have a quote from Johann Kepler.
Love him.
A German astronomer who lived from 1571 to 1630. Kepler is the guy who figured out the laws of planetary motion. And he said, "Why are things as they are and not otherwise?" Very interesting question.
Very cool.
If we could figure that out, then we'll really have something. Why? That's actually a question that scientists are trying to figure out. Is why are the laws of nature what they are?
Yeah, well, that was his underlying premise in everything he studied. That was it.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're right, Evan. And actually, even more so earlier on in natural philosophy or in science, scientists were operating under a real metaphysical paradigm. You know, they thought that there was some kind of cosmic order to things that had a certain aesthetic to it or related to their belief in God or God's plan for the universe. And they were figuring out what the laws of the universe were so in order that they could figure out that bigger metaphysical plan. Isaac Newton was all about that, and Kepler. And then scientists really abandoned that whole approach when they realized that, well, you know, we could describe what the laws of nature are, but there really is no basis upon which we could start to speculate about why they are what they are. And that may always be the case, that we never really can figure out a way of addressing that question about why the laws of physics are what they are.
At the time, it was just so profound. It just had never been phrased or asked before, at least certainly not for many, many, many years, perhaps 1,000 years prior to that.
Some scientists think that that there really, ultimately, really is no reason why the constants of nature are as they are. If for example, we live in a multiverse where every conceivable type of constant has every conceivable type of value, and we just happen to be in one where those constants are consonant with life, and I've heard a lot of scientists saying that that's supremely depressing that would if that is the case, and who knows, maybe the new the Hadron Collider,
mm-hmm.
Maybe that will point us in a direction because scientists do not like just observing these constants and plugging them into their equations. They want to be able to derive them, and if they could do that somehow, that would be truly a wonderful thing. And maybe we'll get there in our lifetimes. That would be great.
Yeah. So it's interesting. We may go full circle back to Kepler and Newton in actually figuring out the underlying why the laws are what they are, not just saying what the laws are.
All right.
Well, thank you all for joining me. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good times.
And Jay will be back with us next week, hopefully with some interesting stories from Sweden. He was contacted, actually, by a number of our listeners in Sweden. I wonder if he had an opportunity to hook up with any of them. That would be fun. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.